Welcome to the Imperial Healthcare Business Podcast. My name is Ivy Adedugbe and I'm your host for today. Today we'll be discussing African healthcare investments, and I've got a wonderful guest with me today. His name is Mr. Saad Sheikh and he works for TLG Capital Investment. So very welcome.
Thank you very much, Ivy. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, so kindly talk us through how you got started in the African healthcare investment space.
Sure. My background is a little bit varied, not healthcare related. I'm an engineer by background, computer systems and electronics, and then went into industry, worked for Nokia for about 7-8 years, both in their mobile phone department and also in the network space. And I can promise you, I'm not the one who led them into where they are today. That aside, after that, I went into consultancy. I did management consultancy at Accenture, working for the financial inclusion products, such as Barclays and other banks, but also with organizations such as Virgin. So that was a very unique and broad experience. And post that, I decided I would like to kind of get my hands dirty into something more entrepreneurial, and you know, join TLG. The founder of TLG is a friend of mine. We go back years and years. We were in school together in grade four, and we started this together. The idea was friends coming together and investing in the African continent where it's needed the most, but also being commercial about it. That's where you get a fairly healthy yield. So by hook or by crook, the couple of deals that we started with were healthcare. Although the fund is broader than healthcare, 60 to 70% of our investments are in the healthcare space, be it manufacturing, distribution, retail, primary healthcare clinics for mother and child care. That's been a key focus because we think that primary care is the most neglected. If I was to jump into the African kind of dynamics of healthcare, $240 billion, if you remember that number, that's the annual additional global spending that is required to achieve SDG 3, which is better health and well-being. That came out of the G7 for Africa. And I'm not talking about globally, but that's $240 billion. The total impact-oriented investments that have been taking place are roughly around a $500 billion mark. So if that amount of investment, half of that was to be positioned for healthcare in Africa would be a much better place. 16% of the global population is living in Africa. 23% of the healthcare burden is borne by Africans. 1% of global spending is on healthcare. So you see the unfortunate truth of the matter, which is Africa does not feel, or Africa is almost like the stepchild. It does not receive the care that it requires. And over the 9-10 years that I've been involved with Africa, that's something that I've gotten to understand, but don't fathom why that is the case. So I guess we're in the space not only to improve it, but also to demonstrate to investors and capital providers that there is a return to be made. Because my view and that of the firm is, healthcare and impact investing impact investing and returns or commercial returns go hand in hand. So if we can demonstrate that through our investments in healthcare, we do feel that other investors will follow, which means that $500 billion of funding could see more of it coming into healthcare in Africa. So that's really the thinking behind it. That's the hope. And the challenge that we're trying to overcome. It's not easy. I'll give you an example of Liberia, where we've got a mother and child care clinic. We wanted to open a dentist chair, call it that. We wanted to help out these women and these young children who dental care. There are only two dentists in Liberia. And one is an 80-year-old lady. And she is the one who we approached. And we said, Madam, could you help us? And she said, I'm too old for this. So the other dentist was not available. So that's the challenge that we find in economies like Liberia, where given capital is one part of the problem, the other part of the problem is where do you get workforce from? And IB, you know this, you do Doctors Without Borders or something along those lines where you fly into Africa to support. We work with the Heart Foundation as well, because there's a dire need for that talent on the continent as well.
And I think you've just hit the nail on the head on the, you know, two or three most important problems on the African continent in terms of healthcare, you know, financial capital, human capital, and sort of organizing both of those together often seems to be the biggest problem as well. So tell me what your biggest challenges that you've faced so far are and how you've navigated around those.
Sure. Well, you ask biggest. If I may just split that into two biggest, because what I'd like to do is, as you rightly articulated, there are two key challenges. One is the financial aspect of it, and I'd like to spell out my biggest challenge around the finance piece.
Yeah.
And second is just the environment piece, you know, and that includes human capital. So why don't I give you two rather than just one, and we can work from there.
Yeah, I'll definitely take all of them.
Cool. So the first one, let me talk about the biggest manufacturing facility, which is WHO pre-authorized in Uganda that we helped set up, that manufactures antiretrovirals and antimalarials. The two biggest causes of death, at least back in 2005 in Uganda, were AIDS and malaria. So we thought, okay, with our partners on the ground and with operators such as Cipla, which is a generics manufacturer out of India, we came up with this proposition where we'd get technology transfer from the Indian manufacturer into Africa for no cost, which is a big feat in its own self. People and pharmaceutical firms don't usually give out their formulas that easily. But thankfully, we got over that hurdle. The government gave us a 33-year authorization or permission to manufacture those. So we built this plant. It's state of the art. It's very well developed. But then you think about how do you get a return for it? So we naively thought listing is a solution to the problem. It became quite a big organization. The government was very keen for us to list in Uganda, so we went ahead with it. Now, from a financial perspective, we invested at a valuation of $25 million, there or thereabouts. We listed the firm at $255 million. So that in itself is quite a feat, because that gives investors 10 times returns. Yeah. But guess what? The Ugandan Stock Exchange is thinly traded, which means the stock price is anything, will move by $1,000. So you can't really get an exit through the IPO market. Something that a lot of fund managers have been banging their drums on, that Africa investment space is not that bad. You can get exits through IPOs. I agree it's not that bad, but I'm giving you an example where we got stuck. We're still in it. We would like an exit, but we're fine where we are. The firm is roughly generating about $70 million of revenue, selling within Uganda, but also 11 countries on the continent, one outside. So I think it's a great solution to the problem, but not the, you know, it's not the full package. Investors didn't see that return. So if we could get to an eventual outcome where even the returns look very good through the public markets, et cetera, then you know that Africa is going to attract a lot of capital. So that was a financial angle. I don't want to just stick to the financial angle because there are more problems that are a little bit wider than that. And this second problem or challenge is in West Africa, at least in Nigeria, that we saw base of the pyramid. Drugs are sometimes fake, sometimes expired. They give it to you in a sachet. You've got no idea where the source of the drugs is. And I've tried that myself. I've gone into mom and pop shops in Mushin, in Akalere, in Oshodi. These are big commuter routes in Lagos. And you get a clear sense of what the base of the pyramid looks like in those areas. So I went into those pharmacies, ordered Panadol or Paracetamol or whatever, and always got it in a sachet. But I never knew what drug it was. It could have been anything. So we developed our own base of the pyramid pharmacy chain called Express, value chain, and background of the product is readily available. We have pharmacists manning the pharmacy, so if you've got a problem, you can get advice from them. But in addition to that, we took a step forward. We created a consultation room right next to the pharmacy. Now, a lot of Nigerians would know, or at least in the healthcare sector, that a clinic with a co-located with the pharmacy is not allowed. The regulator does not allow it. And we had to go through a lot of regulatory hurdles to get allowance for it. So that, because the idea was, the patient walks in, they go through free consultation. If there's a diagnostic, they pay for it. Otherwise, it's free. And for the diagnostic that they've been given, or the prescription that they've been provided, they walk into the pharmacy. So almost a seamless loop. They're interconnected, and you walk in, you walk out, and you don't have to go 10 miles further out to get your medicine. So that was the second problem that I wanted to, a challenge that I wanted to highlight, how difficult it was to put this model in place. Although very intuitive, the regulatory processes didn't allow for it. But, you know, kudos to the regulator. They were amenable to those ideas and willing to change and put processes in. But a year and a half for an early stage business is a significant period of time. That's make or break. So we've thinly kind of come out of it successfully, but it was make or break, especially because of COVID, especially because of riots. And those things don't stop. It's the, you know, it's a norm in those economies where you'll have these riots, you'll have these disruptions, and our real estate took a beating. We had to build it back up. Those are some of the challenges that I wanted to kind of articulate that we've seen on the ground.
Yeah, and you've covered so much ground there. I'm not sure where to start to piece it out. So we'll come to the sort of human capital side of things that you touched on. So, you know, you talked about in Liberia where there were only two dentists in the country. Do you see a role for telemedicine in helping with some of the scaling ideas where you have limited human capital?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that COVID taught us was telemedicine is the way forward. And in both our retail businesses in Liberia, the mother and child care clinic, and in Nigeria, the base of the pyramid pharmacy retail, we've digitized it. We're almost 90% there. We started, it was always part of the strategy, Ivy, I won't lie to you, but there wasn't that push to get it done. Neither the capital available to get it done. So COVID brought two things together. The first push that this was required from a business model sustainability perspective, but two, because of COVID, and thankfully, big kudos to DFIs and development funding organizations like CDC and Sweat Fund, who provided technical assistance to help us through these difficult times. And it was that technical assistance that propelled these projects forward. So sometimes grant-led projects are not a bad thing. I've always been averse to grant because a grant-led project can sometimes become complacent. Because it's free money, there's no real, you know, checks and balances. Although DFIs will contest that, but it's not as stringent as a commercial player would make you sign in blood for the money that they've paid you. DFI is a lot more soft touch. So sometimes that is seen as a weakness, which is very unfortunate. But coming back to the entire value chain created by the tech piece, I think that's superb and phenomenal. How much of that is utilized by the lower end of the spectrum is something that we're testing out, just because they're technology deprived, if I may use that word. But also, internet facilities and internet usage is not that common because of high internet prices. Internet is not free for all. So that makes those type of value propositions difficult. But that said, in Nigeria, it's taken up by you know, it's been supremely successful. 7 out of 8 large insurance organizations have approached us and said, we'll use your services. As a consequence, we're now having to branch out of Lagos and go to Port Harcourt and Abuja, because that's the need of the hour. They've asked us to expand our physical presence there, because that physical presence means we can then deliver. We bought 20 motorbikes from the technical assistance that Swedfund gave us. We need more, but those 20 motorbikes are whizzing all around Lagos at the moment. So the value that it has created, the digital platform, I won't lie to you, but the value that it's created is more for the top end of the pyramid than the bottom end of the pyramid. Yeah. So although our value proposition as it started was targeting the base of the pyramid, I think that will still be brick and mortar for the larger proportion. I think lower to middle and then middle and above will definitely benefit from the technology piece, but not just the lower end just yet. Simply because technology is not that cheap, it's not that readily available, and it's not the mainstay for somebody who has a grocery stall in a marketplace. They won't afford. They won't look to buy data. You know, they'll rather walk into a mom and pop pharmacy shop. So that, I think that gap still remains. And it's an ecosystem evolution that needs to happen. We're not there yet. Although we've been talking to another organization called HFC, the Healthcare Finance Coalition, and they've got a great fund model in place where they want to bring in catalytic capital with commercial capital, put those two together, and really have an impactful healthcare model going on the continent. We're one of three that are participating in this bid. So let's see where it comes through in the watch. But I think that's a good initiative. And those type of initiatives driven by the likes of the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller, WHO, I think they are pretty sound. If they get going and they have the right teams behind them, they can make a huge difference.
And that sounds phenomenal, actually. So I'm just going to come back to one of the points you made about the regulator. And what do you think was the issue with having a clinic next to a pharmacy? Like you said, it sounds intuitive, but was the issue that they think that people, you know, will be luring people to buy medications that they don't need? Or was the issue that they weren't sure that the clinic was going to be manned by clinicians as opposed to just pharmacists?
Yeah. It's a very good question, and I had to dig significantly deep into it because I didn't understand what was going on. So what I found out, the reason this law came into place, at least in Lagos, was because there was this fear that if a pharmacy also has a clinic, they will definitely be incentivized to sell a lot more, whether there's a need or not. Now, that's a very conscientious-related problem. But the way that we've resolved it is, other than the fact that obviously it's the same business, there's no benefit of our clinic recommending a certain medicine. And obviously there's no liability for that individual who's gone in for free consultation to then definitely buy from us. He can take that prescription and walk into a mom and pop shop. There's convenience, but you know, they can do whatever. It's complete freedom. So that's the argument that we gave to the regulator. And it was almost like it was a light bulb that, oh yeah, it was a light bulb moment that true, you're not forcing them to buy. It's not like that prescription can only be used within a pharmacy. So we made that very, very clear that there's no interlinkage between the two. The doctor is incentivized by a salary paid by its own organization. He's not incentivized by writing prescriptions, or she's not incentivized by writing prescriptions. So if they think that the problem is not does not require medication, they just let the patient know and they walk away. The idea of this this model stems from the fact that we want to generate footfall. But remember, where we've installed these pharmacies or put these pharmacies in play, these are very high footfall generating locations anyway. So we're not reliant on the patient walking in to the consultancy, and that's where we convert into the pharmacy. There are numerous patients that will just walk into the pharmacy because they know what they want, it's a repeat prescription, etc., or they want to just, you know, browse. And then they'll see, oh, there's a pharmacist standing behind them, oh, I've got a headache, etc., and they'll get advice then and there. So a lot of people, as I've been told, when you put a nice, shiny is the word that's been used, shop in the middle of these places, people tend not to walk into them. So we do regular community drives. So our doctor will walk into the community and say, this is where we are if you want any help, but also set up a desk and say, you know, come around, I'll see you, whatever the problems are. So we think these community drives attract patients to us so that they're not scared of that shiny environment. Again, that's a new concept to me, right? I mean, it's the inverse here in the UK. You see a shiny shop, you're like, I want to go in there, and, you know, that's where I want to get my medicines from. But these are cultural things that you get a very solid understanding of as you're on the ground. And then you work your models around that. And that's the flexibility that we like to work with our entrepreneurs. And if the model says something different to what we anticipated, we work by the model. Culture eats strategy for breakfast any day of the week. So that's what I believe.
Yeah, no, I mean, you touched on so many points there again. So, you know, knowing your customer, which is, you know, knowing the environment and what's particular to that environment, and learning and, you know, pivoting to make sure that you change the patient journey entirely. So, you know, you've changed that from them going 10 miles down the road to their doctor and then coming back 10 miles to come to the pharmacy. So changing that whole process and making it more seamless for them definitely will improve the value, you know, even in itself of that journey. So, you know, you touched on some geopolitical things that have kind of been challenges in the way. Apart from regulators and understanding the culture and, you know, the diversification of the market, have there been any other political challenges that have stood in the way?
Until 2020, not that many. 2020 was threw a massive spanner in the works. So I won't use this as a general phenomenon. I'll use this as an outlier. Nigeria, I've been investing since, I don't know, 2014 or something like that. So I do believe there's a lot of opportunity there. But one of the political or at least the macro issues that we found ourselves in the midst of was the COVID pandemic hit every economy hard, but in Nigeria, what you saw was dollar liquidity evaporated. Evaporated so quick, nobody had the time to figure out a strategy around it. The hedging for Naira, offshore settled. I remember as naive enough to go and say, oh, by the way, I can get a dollar settled, offshore settled dollar hedge, because I knew we could. I'm thinking this in the midst of the pandemic. So I go and talk to my friends in New York and they say, yeah, you can get one, but it's at 45%. So I'm like, 45%, if that's the cost of the head, there's no return to be made, yeah. Right? So that was an education for me as well. So I went to the central bank and said, central bank, I've done everything right. You've given me a certificate of capital importation. Here it is. I'm sitting on Naira. Here's my CCI, give me the dollars. And the CBN said, well, sorry, get in a queue. So my investors don't understand that. Right? They're like, but you told us you can, you know, it's a 1 year trade or 2 year trade or 5 year trade and you know, let's get it out. So those are the challenges that you have to then work through. And thankfully, we've got a decent network. We know the regulators, we know the central bank to a certain extent. So we lobbied. It took 5 months of lobbying to get them to understand that we won't put any more capital into Nigeria unless we get this liquidity out. The first time we had about $5 million that was outstanding. The first time CBN gave us money was $34,000. So, yeah, exactly. We went to them and said, you know that we need $5 million and you've given us $34,000. There's a bit of a gap in there. So again, the lobbying started, another 2 months went by, but thankfully we got all of it out. I know friends and, you know, other investors who are still stuck 9 months, 10 months in. Now I know it's a short-term problem. Well, short-term is relative for everybody, but I don't think this will go beyond another 6 to 8 months. But when you're in it, you're really kind of blinkered because that's a problem you need to solve. Your investors are on your case. And you really, what hurts is the fact that for no good reason, I mean, the central bank was still sitting on $34 billion as reserves. It wasn't like it was, I think worst case, in a worst dip, I think they were at $29 billion. But I think they were being sensible. They were trying to make sure that in their own perspectives, they were being sensible not to let too much dollar outflow. But the consequence of that is the impression it leaves on the investors, right? The flavor of the month changes very quickly when it is Africa, and it changes even more quickly when problems like this happen. So I thought that may have carried a little bit of negative sentiment towards Nigeria for investors, and that may not have helped. It has made TLG more cautious. I can you know, be very open about that. So we're a lot more cautious about Nigeria than we were. But you know, it was an eventual success that we got the money out. But those type of issues, you rarely find yourselves fighting against in Western markets. That's an African story, where your dollars just get stuck, your Naira depreciates 30-40% in a couple of months. There's some stable currencies out there. Uganda's done well, Kenya's done well. There are some French-speaking African countries that are fairly stable, but they're also pegged to the euro. But we like to be as a, you know, just simply because of, you know, being Anglophone ourselves a little bit, our preference has been Anglophone sub-Saharan Africa. We are trying our best to go into French-speaking, understanding the French law, the common law, etc. We've got a distribution business in the healthcare space in three countries in French-speaking Africa, but you know, we're not there as much as we'd like. So the challenges that I'm talking about are a few examples of what I've been through. I won't have a general broad brush challenge because already Africa has tainted with a broad brush. So I wouldn't want to use that.
Yeah, and you've articulated that so beautifully. You know, as you correctly said, you've got Anglophone Africa and you've got Francophone Africa, and they operate in very different ways. So, you know, my little experience in Senegal, you know, was a perfect example of that. So, you know, you talked about some things there. So foreign exchange, which is the sensitivity of any international business, And I must say, I didn't actually realize you could hedge, in, you know, an African currency. So that's, you know, very unique information to me. And as you correctly said, that was a very expensive way to hedge the difference that you were dealing with. Yeah. So, you know, for any other company that wanted to invest, you know, you've chosen the African continent for many reasons. You know, some reasons which are competitive, you know, in terms of the margins that you can get out of it. The question is, you know, are you in other sort of low income or low technology healthcare space? So, you know, are you in the Asian continent? Are you in the Latin American continent? And if not, you know, what was the attraction to the African continent compared to those?
It's a very good question. We're not. The fund that we're actively investing from is Africa focused, sub-Saharan Africa, outside South Africa. The initial thesis, when we sat down, Zane and I, years ago, and we were thinking about what to do, first opportunity was Africa, because Zane had a pipeline of deals because he was looking at those deals in during his days at Goldman. But second was, which is more underdeveloped, or a better way of using that analogy would be, which is, where can we make a bigger difference with the amount of money that we have, right? We don't have $100 million tickets to deploy in a single deal. As you may have seen, CDCs deployed in Egypt, it's a huge deal. We were deploying anywhere between 2 to 5, going up to 10 million at a max. And where can that really make a difference? And where can we talk to people in a language that we understand, not requiring an interpreter or somebody of that nature? And Africa was the obvious choice. Uganda was the obvious choice. Nigeria actually started with Nigeria. Nigeria was fairly difficult. We looked at a few healthcare deals to start off with. Nothing came to fruition. Then we went into Uganda, and very closely followed by Ghana. We went into Ghana as our second deal. Swedish Ghana Medical Center, which is a cancer treatment facility in Ghana. We were the first investors there. So it was opportunity driven. I had no idea about Africa. I learned about Africa by being on the ground. I was involved in a business that TLG had invested in while I was not full-time in the business. So I went around to turn it. I went down to turn the business around. Because early on, if we started losing money, we wouldn't have had very good traction with investors. Yeah. So I went around, you know, got my hands dirty, turned around a business, a very small business, $2 million revenue. So nothing too glamorous, but really got to the bottom of how businesses and entrepreneurs work. And a lot of pilferage was happening. So that was new to me, you know, trying to put in controls and processes. Yeah. So that's how it evolved. And I would say the opportunity cost and the value, the risk return value that you could get out of Africa on paper at that time when we were doing the analysis was significantly more than anywhere in Asia and in Latin America. Also, language played a role. You go to Southeast Asia, you don't know the language. You go to Latin America, you don't know the language. So. And we still shy away from those areas simply because of language barriers, understanding of the community. And language plays a big role because the way that I do deals is very proactive with the entrepreneur and very collaborative. If there's a language barrier, the collaboration can't be that close. There's always that barrier. I mean, I felt that when I did a deal in Rwanda, because the guys were French speaking, English was kind of second language, I couldn't develop that relationship. Whereas I can do that in Zambia, I can do that in Nigeria, I can do that in Ghana and Uganda and Kenya, et cetera. So I think those points were significantly weighing into our decision, as was obviously the return. Less money being in play on the African continent was also a factor. So I think there were a number of reasons why we chose Africa and stuck to it.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, the main thing that you mentioned there that for me means that you will be there for long term, which is what is needed, is the fact that you're looking to make impact in the space that you're in, so in the healthcare space. And I think as long as you continue with that, you will always be able to make a difference, and you will always find people who are looking to invest in, you know, any projects that you take on. So I'm going to come to, what do you think is the most urgent problem that needs fixing in the African healthcare space? You know, is it infrastructure? Is it, you know, training of staff? What do you think is the most urgent thing that if you fix that today, that will make the most impact?
It's a very good question. And I think it's a $1 billion question, because a lot of these think tanks are putting a lot of effort into finding that, you know, secret sauce. Is there that one little problem that if we solve, the African healthcare will jump, significant improvement? It's a very tough one, IB, I'll be very honest with you. I mean, if I was to look at the public sector, if the public sector could be ramped up considerably in terms of both infrastructure and human capital, collectively, that would play a major role. And the reason I say that is because 40%, if not more, of the population of a country is supported by the public sector healthcare space. There are not that many insurance organizations that support the base of the pyramid. They all run to public sector healthcare. So the biggest dilemma there is, again, you look at public sector hospitals, they're usually neglected. Starting from oxygen's availability of oxygen, or as we were talking the other day, a simple problem as that. You know, I was reading somewhere, if I'm not wrong, I think it was Pakistan, where 9 patients died because oxygen ran out. Those lives could have easily been saved, but that's just an infrastructure problem. So I think the biggest way to solve the healthcare problem is, one, primary healthcare centers run by government or by the public sector funds, if they are brought up to scratch, and when I say up to scratch, I mean basic mother and child care, so that they don't need to end up in tertiary care hospitals or secondary servicing hospitals. They're dealt with by the primary healthcare sector, which is run by the public funds. That will supremely reduce the burden on the tertiary hospitals and the layer below. Because right now, tertiary healthcare is massively overweighed or kind of under a lot of stress, because diseases and problems that could be solved by early stage and primary healthcare facilities as we know them in the West, they don't exist. There's no GP service that you can walk into, do proactive investigations, etc. Right? That's the problem that we try to solve in Express, which is our initiative in Nigeria, the retail initiative, but it's private. Even though it's free to walk in from a consultation perspective, if you need to get a blood test done, if you need to get a malaria test done, if you need to get an HIV test done, you pay for it. That's where the problem comes, because we then use consumables, and we're not a charity, so we can't buy those consumables free of cost. So we buy them with our money, and we have to sell them. So the moment it comes to consumables, we have to charge. But if that was a government-led hospital at significantly discounted rates that people could afford, I think that would be a significant alleviation of the healthcare burden. So if there was ever a magic, you know, magic wand, secret sauce, call it whatever, that would be infrastructure spend for the public in primary healthcare facilities. You sort that out, I think that's a big impact.
Yeah, I think you're very right on that. That, you know, people delay going to hospitals until they're sort of in the late stage of their illness, when actually they probably can't afford whatever treatment is available. So, you know, you talked about the public health system. So my next question is, how do you think African countries can truly fund a public health service? You know, is the way forward to go into public-private partnerships? Or is it to look for foreign investments into into government organizations, so, you know, the Gates Foundation, that kind of organization. What do you think is the best way forward to fund?
And it's a very good question. I recently learned a lot about this sector during my engagements with HFC. And these organizations do genuinely add value because they do a lot of research and think about these problems. So in my mind, the public-private partnership is a no-brainer. That is required. But even the private partnership can't just be commercial capital, because the divide between government way of thinking or government way of doing things and the private sector commercial capital way of doing things is just too far apart. They'll never come together. So the obvious choice is to soften the commercial capital. Way to soften the commercial capital is to create a catalytic layer of capital within the commercial structure, which softens the blow. So as you mentioned, the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller, et cetera, again, bringing the conversation back to what we've been discussing with HFC, that makes sense because let's say it's a $100 million fund. That $100 million, let's say, thinking 20% of that capital is going to be first loss piece, grant money, or catalytic capital. Now, 80% is commercial, but in every deal that you do, the first piece, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, is coming from these donor organizations that are there to help government. And then you've got commercial capital backing. Mm-hmm. You've got to create this layered approach. Government partnering with private engagements, but those private engagements backed by grant money and softer version of capitalism, right? So you kind of bunch them all together. I'm not promising meeting of minds, but I can assure you there will be some steps in the right direction. Yeah. Right now, the only two options that exist are private and public. And that's just a divide. You can't meet that gap very easily. So you bring in the softer layer, in my view. So yes, the way to bring universal healthcare is public-private partnerships to get the infrastructure in place. But then you've got to have some sort of universal payment mechanism, right? So the insurance agencies and organizations need to play a role. One of the ways that they, in my mind, they can play a role is everybody is keen to fund their own healthcare. Bottom of the pyramid, top of the pyramid, everybody has that willingness that we want to put some money for our health. But usually what happens, they put it aside and then there's a, you know, rainy day and they need to pull those savings and you know, it all gets messed up. That's what the insurance is offered. But then the insurance doesn't cover it, et cetera, et cetera. One thing to bring in this universal credit facility is as people go to top up their mobile phones, as people go to buy credit, why don't the government right now, the moment you put in some credit, the government takes a tax. They could easily put a 5% on each discount to pay for your healthcare, right? And then that healthcare is not driven by or that insurance is not driven by hungry fat cats insurance organizations, but government-led insurance organizations that are then monitored by these public-private partnerships where government, private, commercial, and grant personnel all come to the mix and say, okay, this is the pot that we have. This is what we're going to do with the pot. The government is one of the decision makers, but only one of the decision makers. The grant money is also a decision maker, and so is the private capital. So you get the most out of the money that you're putting in. That way, you've got a seamless system where individuals are contributing to their insurance packages, insurance organizations are meeting their liabilities, and then the infrastructure is there for the healthcare to exist, to complement the capital that is there. So I think it's a layered process.
Yeah, and I think you've already answered my next question, which is, you know, how you think hospitals should sort of create their own funding structure so that they're independent. So I'll then sort of come off that question and say, what do you think is the limitation in the, you know, public-private partnership? partnerships, why haven't they happened? Is that because people don't trust each other? Is that because their visions don't align? You know, what do you think is the reason why these haven't been successful so far or have had limited success?
It's a very good question. And it's a very difficult one to answer because there have been so many attempts at public-private partnerships. Not many have been successful, and for a various number of reasons, due to, you know, fraud, due to mismanagement, due to the personnel involved not knowing how to manage it. Because a lot of the time, Westerners are asked to help, and Westerners who are not involved in the culture will lose the plot a little bit. So it's a varied number of reasons, including the personnel, I feel, are the biggest liability, unfortunately. If you have the right people in the right places to make the right decisions, I think there'd be better outcomes. And I'll kind of give you two examples that I've had these conversations in the public realm. I met the Minister of Healthcare in Liberia and the Minister of Healthcare or Minister of Health in Gambia. In both jurisdictions, at least in one jurisdiction, we have a healthcare investment. In the other one, we were trying to, but we never got success out of it. And the conversation goes from, yes, we'd like to put capital into these, into the hospitals, et cetera. You know, we don't have that money. Can we attract it? Yes, we can, but most of that attracted capital goes into other needs. So there's no real solution to the problem. But I'll tell you one biggest problem that the government are facing, and that is healthcare tourism. And the amount of healthcare that people are seeking outside of the borders, but these are government folk. So if they're government employees, the government is actually paying for them to travel to South Africa to get, you know, whatever treatment they need and then come back. If you see the cost associated with it, that is tripling the cost of one procedure for one individual. Then just if you imagine the cost bill that the government has to pay just for its own employees, no wonder it has no money to put to its own people, because they're spending so much on their on external healthcare, be it London. How the higher you are, the better country you go to. Start from Nigeria, then you go to Kenya, then you go to South Africa, then you go to the UK, and then you go to the US, right? So you know, none of these jurisdictions are cheap. So imagine that. So one of the proposals that we had for our friends in Gambia was, and a very, very intellectual health minister, at least at that time, had a very good conversation, was how do we stop that? And one of the proposals that I had is the healthcare investment that I want to make, I can bring it up to scratch to a level where all of the healthcare needs of individuals are met, be it from departments such as urology, the cardiology departments, anything, nephrology, etc. We'll put in an MRI scanner. We'll put in a nephrology machine, etc., etc. And that's what I went into the conversation with. And to be honest, that infrastructure cost would not be more than $5 million. That's all the equipment you need. You're not buying from Germany, you're buying from China, yes, or you're buying from India. You're buying from Germany, that cost goes to $20 million. Plus the consumable cost is huge. So you buy from cheaper jurisdictions, but at least you can make it work for $5, $6, $7 million. Then you need working capital to run it, et cetera, et cetera. So let's say a $10 million facility does the job. But if you think about how much they're spending, according to the numbers that the health minister gave me, is north of $500 million is the healthcare bill just for the ministries, right? And the ministries does not mean the president and that suite, right? Ministries means, you know, just the Ministry of Finance and so on and so forth. So it's a layer below the top. If that's eating so much into your available capital, you know, $500 million is a lot of money. And this is on an annual basis. So you save that money, you keep that in the country, that's Forex saved. it's a huge benefit. It's, you know, it makes a difference within a year. You don't have to borrow, you don't have to pay debt as a consequence. But the will, I think, is lacking on that one. But the jury is still out, right? So, and I'm a very small player in this space. There needs to be bigger initiatives, larger pools of capital, which then almost strong arm these conversations and say, you know, if IMF gives you a debt, you can't send your ministerial staff abroad for healthcare, fix your healthcare internally. That gives you, plausible reason to fix it. That I feel is lacking a little.
Yeah, and you know, it truly just exemplifies the question I was going to ask, which is, you know, with this public-private partnerships, who do you think is the right person to execute this project? Should it be an independent sort of project manager type person, or should it be healthcare professionals themselves, or who should be in charge of actually delivering on any kind of partnership like that?
Wow, the questions keep getting tougher. It's a very good question. Who does it? And I think it's a pool of people, not just from a single industry. Again, these conversations that we've had recently with HSC brought a lot of light to this problem. And one of the case studies we looked at was a remote county in Kenya. And we were trying to bring universal healthcare to it. And the participants there would have been the local government, so be it state government or county government, whatever you want to call them, backed by the state government, so both need to be aligned. Then you need to be on the same page with the commercial investors and the donor organizations, right? So it's a behemoth of a project. Listen, if we can build 50-kilometer long bridges, this is nothing. This is pretty easy compared to those, you know, infrastructure marvels that we've built and we so much pride upon, because they require a lot of collaboration. So healthcare, I feel, can be solved, but a number of participants need to come together. And it's not going to be the first project that is successful. It's going to be, several iterations of it where the same team puts it all together and then realizes from or learns from their mistakes and then, you know, does better next time on. And then you build in industry procedures, and then you build in processes and people start following those. But to kick things off, you need a team of all the participants that are involved in those conversations to come together, be aligned, work together, and try to do something. Yeah. First project, I'm telling you, will be a disaster, but keep at it. That will needs to continue because the motive is bigger than one or two of us. It's for our future. It's for our future generations.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. So that brings me to, what do you look for in a project before you decide to be an investor to bring some investment into it? You know, what's the typical ROI that you're looking for in these projects as well?
Well, that's an interesting one. So there are two ways that we think about it. One is a top-down. So let's say we think about, a problem that is in Africa, let's say it's very topical, let's say it's vaccinations not being manufactured in Africa. So let's say we come up with a plan and we find operators and we find a few financiers that support us, we'll go into that because from a top-down, at least from a thematical perspective, it makes sense. I would say we've only done two deals at most out of the 25 deals we've done so far that are thematic. Mostly it is an opportunity presents itself and we weigh out the option and understand the business model and figure out whether there's the business model makes sense, but two, is there would the return on this deal make sense to us, right? So that's a key question to us. We're commercial investors followed by impact. So we've got to look at what our investors are going to ask for. So the value proposition really comes from the business model is at a point where new capital will grow it. So it's a proven model. It's been tested. Its deliveries are effective. And there are two, three efficiencies that we can bring to the model. One is through scale, potentially, as we did in Nigeria. More capital means scale. That means more patience, more volume. That means more return. So that's a simple model. And then the second one is more aligned to if it's not as scalable from brick and mortar perspective, is it value accretive even in small numbers, right? So if we do a nephrology clinic in Rwanda, does it make sense? Are there enough high-paying customers or insurance organizations that are going to bring patients to it? If so, let's do it. It's not going to be for the base of the pyramid, but it's value accretive. So those are some of the things that we think about. The return on investment is a good question. In, on a dollar basis, I look at double digits. Double digits in the teens, if I can. Sometimes I get into the 20s, and that's a big win. In some cases, very few cases, I've gotten to 30% IRRs. They've been very, very successful. I exited one of my deals last year in the fuel retail space, where we brought in a lot of ESG elements. We brought in solar panels for all our stations, etc. We grew it, I think, about 14 times on a revenue basis and really streamlined the business. And we got a 35% IRR on that one. So, but those are just absolute winners. Not all our deals are going to be those winners. So anywhere between 15 to 20 is a good return for us.
That sounds amazing. So what advice would you have for anyone who wants to go into this space from what you've learned so far?
It's a tough space. it's not for the faint-hearted. I will say it requires a lot of perseverance, a lot of motivation. But as long as that drive is to create value, both for the recipients and your investors, I think you'll enjoy this space. There are some hair-tearing moments as well. I've grown a few gray hairs as well. So it gets you out of bed. It gets you excited. There's definitely more to be done. So I would highly recommend it, but I would say two things or two kind of pieces of caution. One, small amounts of capital in the space won't get you anywhere, right? So I would advise larger pools of capital going into the healthcare space and pursuing that. So smaller funds would struggle. And two, have somebody in the healthcare space, at least an expert in the healthcare space from any sector, right, to be with you in the journey. That helps a lot because it's a very nuanced environment. And sometimes from a commercial perspective, it makes sense. But from a patient journey perspective, it doesn't. And healthcare professionals can help you. You can sometimes seek external advice, but external advice is, is chasing value for themselves. So they won't be that strategic. If you have somebody in-house with that strategic angle, that's very valuable in my view. So those are a few thoughts that I would share.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. I truly enjoy this conversation, and that brings us to the end of this. So thank you very much for your time.
Ivy, thank you very much for having me. I had an absolute joy. Thanks for the tough questions. Makes me think a lot. I really enjoyed it. So I appreciate the time.
Thank you.